Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Companion. I'm your host for the next little while, Dale Graham. Thanks for coming back. And if you're new to the show, welcome. The intent is only to be a bit conversant, to be entertaining and informative. And I hope you enjoy the next couple of minutes on topics that hopefully will be of some interest to people with Masonic inclination, shall we say. And other than that, the ideas, the principles, the value, the goodness of Freemasonry is certainly not sitting in a Masonic vault anywhere. These are ideas and values that are universal and often lost to in the rush, often values and principles not taught specifically. And within Freemasonry, there is a hope that we recapture ways of better understanding the principles of a philosophical life, an examined life, and how to and the means of developing a lifestyle that reinforces and encourages that self-awareness and focus. Over the next little while, you'll see that I'll try and make a contribution. And as always, I wait for the advice of the audience. The ideas that we talk about here certainly are opinion pieces. And I can't really move ahead with this without your able assistance. And as you know, the episode today referred to as Eye, Observation, and Understanding. And you can see sort of with all, each of these topic headings, the thoughts that have been running loosely through my head over the past week or so, and I try and bring them forward in a new topical format. This is early morning here. May not be when you're sitting down to it. I have my comfortable chair and a nice glass of something comfortable in my hand. And I hope you do too when you're able to do that when you're listening. Whether you're behind the wheel of the car or you've found a quiet moment when you can put on the headphones and listen and not be interrupted, or you're sitting with the lights dimmed and a nice glass of single malt, you know the atmosphere. I do tend to think that we are here in Ontario blessed because of the very strong infrastructure that was built. And like anything else, you know, it's a huge, huge, growing, organic process. It's now adapting to another stage of expectation, another stage of development and growth, and we're getting into the atmospheres. Creating the atmospheres that are conducive to deeper understanding, that have not replacing what we have, but adding to it. We've built a wonderful foundation for the cathedral. Think of it that way. But now we're ready to move out of the basement. And now we can see what kind of vaulted walls we are capable of constructing and how great the space inside will be and how beautiful and humbling our architecture will be as we think about the future. So move your mind 100 years into the future. Practical man will have to rub shoulders with the dreamer in order to build. One needs the other and needs the respect of the other in order to accomplish our goals. So this dreamer, as you know, here on the 1st of December, yippee, the 335th day of the year, my expectation is that we take charge, that we bring that positive influence that we want. When we close our eyes and think about the kind of celebration of this time of year that would be exquisite, that would help us to relive every wonderful moment, that capacity lies within the heart of every Mason. And if we sit back silently waiting for that to happen, then we'll sit back silently watching the season go by. And sadly, we'll be missing that opportunity, the opportunity to bring forward the joy and positive good feeling means really focusing on doing that for other people. And you know that if you've studied your catechism, Masonic catechism, you will know that. You will know that that the service that we provide to other people opens up new levels of learning and awareness within us. So let's not kid ourselves. If we are serious about achieving a deeper happiness and satisfaction with our life, particularly over, it's a nice little experiment, you want to try it, over the next couple of weeks, the key to that rests not with the outside world, not with the television media, not with the ads, but within your heart and your mind. See what kind of a difference you can make to bring smile to somebody else's, to somebody else, to bring some joy to somebody else. And that means learning to, yes, even at our ripe old age, learning to hold ourselves, to control ourselves, to be more self-aware, ever more self-aware. And accept the fact that that task is always incomplete. So, pull up your Santa Claus outfit and take a look around and start to find the joy, because it's infectious. That is one thing that we do know. That kind of pleasure is absolutely infectious. When you can walk in and bring a smile to somebody else who's feeling the weight of the world on their shoulders, and it will, if we are as good as our values, it will not be somebody that looks and sounds like us. It will be the antithesis. It will be somebody that does not sound like us, that does not carry our values. That's the most important influence of all, to be able to connect with that person in a humanist, empathic way, and to bring satisfaction and joy. Those are the deeper values of Freemasonry, as we all know. Easier said than done? Absolutely. Now, I don't want to carry on too much here, because I tend to do that, I think. So I'll move on with a little bit of an explanation of what I was thinking about, just to, you know, again, as the context for today's program. And then we'll get into, I keep thinking about age and time and space. And now, the new findings, we are now talking about time-space, a different kind of phenomena, and how there's different times for people around the world. And this is a real head shaker. I looked at my watch, and of course, when you sit and look at your watch, we have the same time. But we know from the experiments that were done, if you get on an airplane with your timepiece and you fly around the world and we compare our time when you get back, that those two watches, even though they were set at the identical point, will be different. Oh yes, make no mistake. Emotion does affect our perception of time, whether we're standing still or moving. Yes, standing still, it seems to go faster. So, get moving. How are we doing so far? A little bit of context on the 335th day of the year, 24 days until Christmas, 23 days until Christmas Eve. I hope you're going to be tuning in the Vienna Symphony Orchestra on New Year's Eve. Ha! All of the hassle of getting there, all of the headache and fussing to get there, and to have a well-pressed tuxedo to slip into with my beautiful wife at my arm to sit in those seats and listen to it. I have to think I can sit in my tux in my living room, turn on the program, have pretty good sound system, a nice glass of whatever, a glass of wine, maybe some Aberoni in my hand, and enjoy the music. Absolutely enjoy the music. Feel good about it. And feel good about it. And then not have to, you know, those types of things. I don't, you know, maybe I am thinking wrongly. Some of those types of defining events are worth every bit of the sacrifice. After the concert, going out to a dinner and having a few drinks and making a night of it. Well, you know, how could I pass that up? I couldn't. But right now, this year, it's beyond my my inclination. So the best I can do is if you were inclined to that kind of a New Year's Eve, if you're inclined to raising hell and bonfires and fireworks to celebrate the 2014, by all means, and give it a little extra boost for me. I'll be there with you in spirit. Discussion helps find the social comfort level, always. When we sit down and talk about contentious issues, it's that back and forth where we start to find the waters blending, the chemistry between us, finding that comfort level. And some people can't, you know, fly off the handle, hotheads, unable to control their emotion, blah blah, you know, and then they walk around thinking that, you know, they're dangerously imperiled because they think they know what they're talking about and have all the answers. And after the age of, what is it, about 15 or 16 years old, I thought adolescents knew all the answers. So after that, I'm really not trusting you. If you're an adolescent, you know all the answers. You've got me. Of course, you know all the answers to the secrets of the universe. After that, you're just guessing. And you rob us of the probing on the thinking of each other's minds. Oh, excuse me. I found something soothing for my cough. Thank you. Discussion helps find the comfort level. In fact, it makes all the difference. Something special all the day. A dash of stoic is probably useful for that moment when Mr. Docking steps forward with such pertinent matters that one would want to address to avoid sounding vacant. You know, suck it up. Be ready for being put on the spot. The Docking that I'm talking about is really this fellow that's challenging whether we sort of live in this fantasy about the Creator. Well, you've heard me talk about, you know, a little bit about that. Yes, you have your own sense of the Creator, but I don't want to, if I was to have that kind of serious conversation, I would hope that I wouldn't just be stamping my foot and being upset and being recalcitrant. I would hope that I would be able to say something thoughtful and intelligent and not just make a fool of myself. So that's really what I'm talking about, that vacancy. Oh, my goodness. What are you saying? Don't talk to me. I'm going to cover blah, la, 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 la. Well, there is a point. Is there a point? How do you know it? Too much to handle? Go back to the garden, start weeding. The answers will come to you. Of course, that would satisfy my own notion that people are generally a thoughtless bunch until they feel a vested interest in the topic. People don't, unless you, you know, how many times have I seen somebody not really paying much attention to the world around them until something affects them personally, something that intrudes in their prescription of their safe, predictable life. Then they find a new importance. Then they find their cause or their issue. There are other people that don't wait for the calamity before they look around and realize that there are people that need assistance. So many children in Canada going to bed hungry and waking up hungry. Bit of a disgrace, more than a shame, and something we need to remedy. But that's kind of an example of what I'm talking about. Doesn't matter unless you're one of those hungry people, I guess. Or if you've ever come from that kind of a background where you know what hunger is or what it means to do without, and you go through your whole life budgeting and being aware, being grateful for what you have, being accepting. Do we want to be part of the portion of thinking, reasoning people? Do we want to be part of that group? Or are we satisfied by default with the alternative? You know, the masses, we follow around and we're referred to as sheep. Somebody on television comes up with an idea and I say, right, that's my idea. Not because I've reasoned it through, but because somebody else came up with the idea and it gets me off the hook. I don't have to do the reasoning. I can appeal to the higher authority. Well, somebody in this position said it, so it must be true. A bit daft when you say it that way, but it happens all the time. So do we want to be part of that group of people that wrestle with these ideas, that realize that the answers don't come easily? This seems to put pressure on me. Common sense tells me there's an infinite number of essential questions. I am 64. Even though I take in information differently today than when I was a 10-year-old boy, the clock ticks off time the same. Today, it seems as we age, we feel a need to interrupt change. Our perception remains as it has been, but we tire more quickly. Our bodies and minds need to be fed differently. Knowing this is key to a renewed sense of mastery and accomplishment. Today, this key, we are rudderless fools. Without this key, we are rudderless fools stranded on a shore. Today, being unable to thoughtfully address serious questions of life would be a sign that, for me, that I have squandered this life. If I'm clueless about these, that I've never given them a moment of thought, the life unexamined is not worth living, as Plato said. Freemasonry heightens the expectation for answers. Oh my. Is there an explanation of the entire universe? Would a magnificent God be an entity to negotiate favors? You know, I'll turn my life around if you'll only give me this one. That conducts magical acts, you know. Is the Creator limited to human qualities? Well, the Greeks sort of tore that one up, didn't they? If I could say, this is the way the Creator is, that's limiting the Creator to the thinking of a mortal and not something that is immortal, something that is greater and more magnificent. Of all that is in the universe, we are bags of molecules. We seem to be the only bags of molecules that are able to understand it. Is there purpose to that consciousness? Is there a reason why? You know, what is the, you know, this, these bags of molecules are able to understand or attempt to understand. What's the purpose of that? Are we destroyers of our own existence? You know, we clamor for the natural resources more and more. We run into complications, and then we adjust to those complications gradually and afterward. Our history reveals quite that sense of adjustment. Not that we don't pay a serious price, of course we do, but when things are unsustainable, we have a capacity for tolerating a great price and then gradually doing something about it, always with the risk of repeating our own failure. Are we by nature xenophobic? Are we by nature paranoid? Are we by nature tribal animals? And the reason I ask that question is, if we're thinking about this notion of universality, all people being one, and then we think even in the scripture that I was brought up with, there was an event where people were sent away and began speaking different languages. In other words, it was difficult to understand, difficult to communicate through language. So it made me wonder, are we xenophobic by nature? Do we not want other people around us? You know, do we want people that look like us and sound like us? We want to live and that's where we're happy. Then is that our nature or are we taught that? Well, son of a gun, I was one of those folks that were taught, you know, different languages, different accents, different lifestyles, different values, different foods. Wonderful, wonderful. Different values, different cultures, living shoulder to shoulder, adjusting, just out of sheer necessity, and not doing too badly a job. Are we tribal in that sense? Or are we capable of casting a web of trust that connects all peoples as brethren? This is where you can tell I seriously need your advice. It's hard for me to sort that out. Very, very difficult to sort that out. So, where do we go from there? I want to remind us that Freemasonry is a process of different levels of thinking. And for me to, or anybody, I find it very limiting if somebody is trying to protect one dimension of Freemasonry. There's nothing really to protect. It stands well on its own without protection. It endures even beyond our short-sightedness. Of course it does. It's been around for so many hundreds of years. With a very, very solid philosophical foundation. So to be pretending that it's prone and it's vulnerable to fall apart, I mean, really, we have to decide, is there any strength and merit in what's brought Freemasonry forward to the 21st century or not? If there is, then I think it deserves our attention and we deserve to embrace it like that. No, it's not a power, it's an understanding. It's a I get it moment. It's a way of comprehending what's happening around us. It's enlightenment. And in the meantime, we are in various stages of incompleteness. Can I say it that way? Yeah. And quite comfortable with that, always seeking to improve, but able to acknowledge that we're a work in progress. It's pretty simple. Time, eh? I want to be generous, and I'd like you to all be generous with yourselves and each other. You know, the age of the universe that the bosons started to reveal, 13.82 billion years. 13.8, I heard that it takes about 40,000 years, or I read, about 40,000 years for a proton to get from the center of the sun to its surface. And then to get from the surface of the sun to Earth is a matter of minutes. What? Thank goodness we have physicists. The Earth, on the other hand, is about 4.54 billion years old. Yeah. You know, it makes me wonder what was going on for those 9 billion years in between, you know? Well, there are some answers to that speculation theory. Humans, you and I, we're about 2.2 million years. 2.2. No, that's not billion. That's... And if you don't mind, a little departure here. About the things that don't matter that do matter. The age of... I'm thinking about the things that seem to be needlessly quarrelsome. I truly respect people's difference in the way that they, their faith and their worship. I truly do. The ages. I'd never raised this question before. The age of Christianity, about 33 BC, about that period. Judaism, it dates from the Bronze Age, but about 2,000 years. And Hinduism dates from the Iron Age, a little bit beyond that. Islam, the nation of the Islam, is about 14 centuries old, from about 600 AD. Buddhism, dates from the 5th century BC. And Confucianism, about 500 BC. Protestantism, 6th century. Roman Catholicism dates from between the 1st and the 5th century. Paganism, early 20th century. I'll give a rough idea. I know that these dates are probably going to be challenged and certainly much more accurate, but just perspective. What's the beauty of all of this is that over the throughout the history of mankind, you can see the importance of trying to come to an understanding of a higher power, of that sense of wonder, of the sense of reason and an explanation for all that is. And I've seen it. So we start off today with that notion of context again. The part that I want to talk about is to go back to the idea of influences and atmospheres. We have ritual that was developed and built on ideas that came from much earlier periods of history. And I want to just talk a little bit today about Elizabethan England, which was fairly, you know, which was significant in the discussions and development of some of the ritual thinking, the form that the ritual thinking took pre-Grand Lodge era. Everyone who lived in Elizabethan England was at least publicly a Christian, and by today's standards, devout. This is from a paper by Geoffrey Bissery. And it's taken from a portrait of Elizabeth I, edited by Robert Pringle. And it has references from Comparative Elizabethan Religion by Mr. Tim Duncan. So the 16th century. Now, this is a period that I find very, very interesting because I think that I believe that our thinking leading up to Grand Lodge, our collective Freemasonic, okay, was influenced by the periods and major epochs that were occurring in the century and the two centuries prior. 16th century was a time of considerable religious change. Now, look at it this way. Over a period of 20 years, the country had gone from Henrician Catholic to Protestant to Catholic to Protestant again. And it was therefore important that you understood all those beliefs and how they differed. In the Elizabethan age, the church was an inseparable part of both public and private life. Attendance at its services was obligatory, and whole areas of personal morality and behavior were subject to its authority. Debate about theological matters was not an academic exercise, but often became a passionate issue for the man in the street. Religion could be a disruptive force which divided families, and communities and individuals were likely to be imprisoned or hanged for their faith. When Elizabeth came to the throne, the country had experienced 25 years of religious upheaval. Her father, King Henry VIII, had abolished the Pope's power in England and had become supreme head of the church himself. Although the country remained doctrinally Catholic under Henry, he precipitated the Reformation, and when he was succeeded in 1547 by his son, King Edward VI, the church became essentially Protestant in doctrine and practice. When Queen Mary I, a devout Catholic, succeeded Edward in 1553, most of the ecclesiastical changes introduced by Henry and Edward were swept away, and Catholicism was restored. In her drive to stamp out Protestant heresy, about 300 people were burned at the stake in less than 5 years. Elizabeth did not share her sister's deep religious temperament, and though she held firm convictions of her own, she pursued a tolerant, unfanatical approach to religious questions. The famous church settlement established by Acts of Parliament at the start of her reign was a compromise solution calculated to be acceptable to as many Catholics and Protestants as possible, and was designed above all to restore strength and unity to a divided kingdom. It reestablished the Protestant prayer book of Edward VI, but with alterations that made it more palatable to Catholics, and it revived royal supremacy over the church, though in a milder and more parliamentary form than under Henry VIII. The settlement survived all manner of vicissitudes and provided the conditions from which the Anglican Church was successfully developed to this day. So that idea, we might think more globally, but the idea of embracing any religion, you sidestep that question of Catholic or Protestant. Although you and I say, yes, this was Christian either way. So what's the difference? Well, we have other faiths that are within one doctrine, but have different approaches. One particular. So here we have in the history, the Christian history in Britain, we have this type of struggle back and forth. Was this significant, and would this have been influential? I would argue with you. I would make the argument that yes. It helps us to explain the importance of embracing fellows of all faiths. All faiths. See, in 1569, Elizabeth had put down a serious rebellion led by the Catholic earls of Westmoreland and Northumberland. The next year, Pius V issued a papal bull of excommunication and disposition against Elizabeth. Faced with these challenges, the Queen was forced to act. Parliament passed a series of severe anti-Catholic measures. It does go on. The papal bull presented a particularly serious challenge to the regime and a fearful dilemma to Catholics, since in absolving all subjects of their allegiance to the Queen, it forced them to choose between their religion and their national loyalty, and made them, in the eyes of the government, potential traitors. Again, I think this brings back that notion of discussion. We keep the discussions of faith and politics at arm's length, not within the walls of a lodge. And here we have this is so serious. The impact so grave on people's lives that thinking men and women, but particularly thinking men at the time, would realize that it was a very destabilizing power that was being influenced. So all of a sudden, we may have church and state continuing to quarrel, but you have a body of like-minded men that say, doesn't matter. You're free within this framework, within this group, to worship the way you want, to think what you want. You have politics, go ahead. You have political opinion, go, yes, we're perfectly fine. But we won't discuss them here because that would be divisive. That would be quarrelsome. And we want to encourage good-natured discussion. I would suggest to you that this papal bull, this period of 1569, was enormously powerful and resonated on well into the time when Grand Lodge was being developed, and the people that were creating the Constitution were thinking about the importance of some of the influences that would protect the ancient and accepted Freemasonry well before it was ancient and accepted. At the same time as the Catholic threat intensified, a growing body of reforming Protestants voiced their dissatisfaction with the Elizabethan Church. Most of these Puritans, so-called because they wished to purify the Church of all remaining vestiges of Catholicism, accepted the existing structure of the Church and merely demanded an improved standard of clergy and the removal of impurities in doctrine and ritual. Others, however, went much further, attacked the government of the Church by bishops subjected to the royal supremacy, and sought a Presbyterian, i.e. elected, style of church order. The Queen's distaste for the Puritan attitude of mind, with its solemn disavowal of the ordinary pleasures of life like music and sports, added fuel to her growing aversion to the political implications of Presbyterian doctrines. In her view, civil and church government were two aspects of one state, and the Puritans' refusal to accept the latter implied opposition to the former. The more radical Puritans, indeed, openly voiced the claim that the final authority in all matters of government lie with the National Synod or Assembly of the Presbyterian Church, and that even monarchs were subject to its jurisdiction. Heavy duty. Throughout the mounting religious controversy of her reign, the Queen remained fundamentally concerned with the safety of the kingdom rather than with the theological claims of Protestant or Catholic. The political and not the spiritual import of religion was her prime interest. Since she believed that the essence of religion was deeply personal and that men might come to God from different paths, it was not her wish to pry into individual conscience, but only to enforce a degree of outward religious conformity in the interest of national unity. She had an antipathy to religious dogmatism and is said to have declared that there is only one Jesus Christ and one faith. All right, let's be generous with her for the sake of this period. The rest is a dispute about trifles. Okay. When she was a good Christian woman, wasn't she? When she addressed Parliament in 1585, I would imagine a good Buddhist woman would have said something different, or a Muslim would have said something different, or a Hindu, and all being able to raise the same point in our thinking. When she addressed Parliament in 1585, she declared her opposition both to Catholic agitators and the newfangledness of the Puritan extremists. Can you imagine the insufferable nature of living with the Puritans? Oh my! And do we understand why they pulled themselves into, why they felt persecuted in Europe, and packed themselves in their Puritan boats and made their way to North America? Begins to make sense, and starts to make sense when we think about the, you know, all that. Did all that go offshore? Not quite. There were considerable continuity of tradition, despite the religious changes of the reign, as shown in the fact that many foreign visitors who attended English church services were surprised to find how little they differed in form from the old Catholic rituals. The ceremonies Elizabeth maintained in her own chapels reflected her innate conservatism about religion, as with many other matters. Now, you decide for yourself, gentlemen, and ladies, if you happen to be out there. Decide for yourself whether these types of influences in 16th century would have had a bearing on the thinking of people developing the Constitution and principles and landmarks of Freemasonry. You come to grips yourself with that, of course. I tend to think that, that was part of it. That was part of the influence. And I tend to think, too, that that the idea of the ritual, the notion of ritual, was also greatly influenced by the public demonstrations of the guilds. And I'm thinking back to a very early time, and I'm guessing here 15th, 16th century, where the guilds in certain towns, developed towns, would on one day of the year perform a parade that portrayed a part of a story of scripture. And the more significant the guild was, the more powerful or older it was, the more primary was the story that it told. And I'm thinking about the primariness. Again, I apologize to people because of the limits of my own background. But you will find in your own faith, I'm sure, references to mythology and history, sort of a quasi-history, that brings out a certain idea. So the more valuable, let's say, put it that way, the more central types of themes would be Adam and Eve, or Noah's Ark. And the more powerful and old guilds would portray that in a cart, with much as you see today, if you go in Granada in Spain, where those very massive structures are carried through the town as a reflection of the commitment to faith. The lesser guilds in the time would have sort of so-called peripheral themes as their topic for their carts that would be walked through in solemn procession through the town. And so the guilds themselves became in those areas became associated with these mystery plays. Now, I think it becomes important for us to ask ourselves some questions about mystery plays. Is the ritual of Freemasonry a demonstration of mystery plays? And I would think that there is reason for us to argue that, yes, there is. Yes, it is. Because these things were going on in the past. And if you were starting up an organization and you want to bring in some provenance, some, you know, seriousness about it, you want to connect yourself with something very, very old, this would be a splendid way of doing that. And again, it's sort of, what does it do about that notion of talking, not of protecting and preserving a discussion? So we stay away from topics of religion and politics. But here we have the portrayal of something with a spiritual, you know, theological reference, where you could argue that it's sort of quasi-religious, isn't it? Yeah, but not. Anyway, think about that as a further influence, in the thinkers that put together the Constitution. Why so liberal-minded? Why? The first known use here. Let me take you sideways for a little bit, okay? The first known use of the word Freemasons in the form Freemasons occurs in the City of London letter, Book H of 9 August 1376. Though the word is in fact deleted in favor of Masons, so they had the word Freemasons, and they stroked it out and put in Mason. Masons and Freemasons were interchangeable during the 15th and 16th centuries, and Freemasons were generally meant to denote hewers or setters of free stone, Masons being used to embrace all stoneworkers. Ashmole, oh yes, I'm not near finished to his book, The Magnus. When I am, I'll do a review of that for you all. Interesting, Elias Ashmole. contributed majorly to the Royal Society. Ashmole, in his diary, wrote that he was made a Freemason and referred to 1686 to the Fellowship of Freemasons. James Anderson, when writing his 1723 Constitutions, did not use the single word Freemasons once. Whatever the reasons, the 1723 Constitutions contained approximately 126 references to Masons, 12 to Freemasons, 10 to free and accepted Masons, 9 to free hyphen Masons, 1 to accepted Freemasons, and none to Freemasons. And such is the tenacity of tradition that to this day, the most of the constitutions are addressed to free and accepted Masons and not to accepted Freemasons. The earliest known anti-Masonic leaflet of 1698 warns the public against those called Freemasons, almost certainly what we now know as speculative Freemasons. That's an interesting, that's from a paper from Quattro Coronati Lodge number 2076, United Grand Lodge of England. And that's the educational initiative of 2012-13. So tuck that one in your pocket. That's a little bit of curiosity, a little curious piece about the word Freemason. And it really does, it just drips with antiquity, doesn't it? You know, we just sort of flip off the fact, well, we'll just go back to references in the 14th century, and then we'll just zip ahead to the 18th century. It's like that's the trap and the beauty of the free and accepted Freemasonry, that we are able to move through so fluidly through time. It just makes the speculation and opinion that much richer. It is the spice in the stew. I don't think that in my mind that it adds at all to the confusion of to any kind of confusion. It speaks so strongly about the nature of Freemasonry. Now, again, just a little tiny influences here. This is about Alexander Pope. You know about Alexander Pope. Interesting guy. Claimed to be the greatest English poet. He was born in 1688. Just want to share with you a bit of the idea. I found him uncanny. When I think about what I know about Freemasonry, to err is human, to forgive divine. That's from Alexander Pope. To be angry is to revenge the faults of others on ourselves. To be angry is to revenge the faults of others on ourselves. And he also said, these are things that we've heard from school days when we were boys. Teach me to feel another's woe, to hide the fault I see, that mercy I to others show, that mercy show to me. He says, this is on education and will, some people will never learn anything. For this reason, because they understand everything too soon. Blessed is the man who expects nothing, for he shall never be disappointed, was the ninth beatitude. Many men have been capable of doing a wise thing, more a cunning thing, but very few a generous thing. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pyrian spring. Parian, you could say. P-I-E-R-I-A-N. Type that in. The difference is too nice. Where ends the virtue or begins the vice? Act well your part. There all the honor lies. The learned is happy nature to explore. The fool is happy that he knows no more. Interesting, eh? Somebody that's completely happy, doesn't have a clue, and really not interested. Trust not yourself, but your defects to know. Make use of every friend and every foe. Histories are more full of examples of the fidelity of dogs than of friends. Ouch. True ease in writing comes from art, not chance, as those who move easiest have learned to dance. How happy is the blameless Vestal's lot? The world forgetting, by the world forgotten. So, act well your part. There all the honor lies. I'll just leave you with this last one. Teach me to feel another's woe, to hide the fault I see. The mercy I to others show, that mercy show to me. Teach me to feel another's woe. Alexander Pope. Maybe you agree he was the greatest. He was born on the 21st of May. So what's that? Taurus? My friend Anita is a Taurus about that time, I think. Let's see. And he's a poet, of course, in English. And he died on the 30th of May of 1744. Is this the type of thing that would be influential? I'm thinking probably. Here, I've actually dug out some quotes from Pythagoras. Just beautiful, beautiful things. But let me move on here and get into something a little more, you know, feeding you what you came for. You must be hungry. You're just a hungry lot. And we'll collectively sip on our Kool-Aid right now. me. This is some work by, some of you will know this fellow, I'm sure. W. Kirk McNulty. Brother, W. Kirk McNulty. Whence did we come? And you'll get this in the volume 124 of the Ars Quattro Coronatum, the work over the past couple of years. This came from 2011. And it was presented in Lodge number 13 on the 13th of September last year. And this is about the 3 degrees of Freemasonry. And over the years, you've heard me say that, you know, when we started, we didn't have the 3 degrees as we know them today. And so, of course, you begin to puzzle, like, how did they really come together and how did they form? I'll make a little note to come back to Jean Desolier, who you've heard me mention so many different times, you're probably going to give me a bit of stick about it. But it's funny how, you know, some of these things just come around. So I'm going to talk to you a bit about the 3 degrees of Freemasonry are said to take place in King Solomon's temple. The first degree takes place on the ground floor, the second degree in the middle chamber, and the third degree in the vicinity of King Solomon's porch, the porchway entrance to the Holy of Holies. When looking at information of this sort, most people, Masons and non-Masons alike, consider it from a historical perspective. But McNulty considers this material about King Solomon's temple from a different point of view, from the perspective of the most important teacher in the history of Western civilization, who said, "Know ye not that ye are the temple?" Know ye not that ye are the temple? Get your mirror out. Ask yourself, who is the temple? Look in the mirror. Yeah, you've got it. No, I'm just kidding you. You know, he's talking about the temple, you, me. And again, that's oh my goodness. You mean I can't just sit back passively in the shadows and let all of this importance have to do with another person? You mean it really is about putting myself out there? examining the warts and flaws as well as the strengths, whatever that might be. All right, McNulty, let's see what you got to say. Be gentle. We're just a group of Freemasons. In that context, the path through the degrees is an interior journey. It is a journey in consciousness through three levels. I'm beginning to like this. The physical world, the ground floor, the psychological world of the soul, the middle chamber, and the spiritual world, King Solomon's porch. How many times have I wanted, when I sat there and somebody would say, enjoy your journey, and the Solomon's, you know, chair, absolutely no explanation, no context. If you, you know, put up my hand and say, what the hell are you talking about here? Just give me something here. So here it is. McNulty, I'm loving you. I might put you in the will if this gets any better. The reason for choosing this perspective, say, I don't want to take you away. You're being serious there for a second. So the ground floor, physical, then the psychological, and then the spiritual. The reason for choosing this perspective is that that McNulty seeks to demonstrate a connection between Masonic symbolism and the ideas of the intellectual community that was guiding Western thought at the end of the Renaissance. During the Middle Ages, the source of information was authoritarian. Yuck. This is the way it is. Don't give it a second thought. Here's your idea. This is the way it is. And by the way, I am going to punish you if you get uppity, you start challenging. Boy, these are fellows that are they're lucky they weren't around in the 60s. There'd been sit-ins and crap going on. Anyway, I digress as a baby boomer. During the Middle Ages, the source of information was authoritarian. The church told everyone what they needed to know. The Renaissance was different. For the intellectual community, and let's consider all of the listeners part of that, the source of information was empirical. One learned by understanding what one had observed. It was from that the idea of physical science emerged. Science was developed by those members of that intellectual community that were interested in the physical world, and this intellectual frame of reference was formalized in 1660 with the founding of the Royal Society. And clearly I'm going to have to do some work on Elias Ashmole and the Royal Society. Clearly. I'm being forced into an upcoming show. But there was another group in that intellectual community that was different. That other group, and this may include you and me, that other group was interested in the philosophical aspects of life, in the nature of the human being. I think the brethren that were members of the casual lodges and met in pubs in the late 1660s were of that other group. That's the hot dog and beer group. If you were in the 1660s part of that hot dog and beer group, just wanted to have a good time, this is what you did. You didn't just sit there and get legless and cross-eyed. This is what you talked about. You had a drink, you sat in the pub, it was a very convivial environment, you said things philosophical. I like you so far, McNulty. This is the group that was a bit different, eh? So you had an intellectual group interested in the physical world, but you also had this group that formed around philosophical topics. I can't say that it's much different today, can you? You know, there's those boys that just roll up their sleeves. They're fantastic. Go out, fundraise, giving to generously, philanthropists. You know, you need something. We sort of suck our teeth and grind them when we see somebody that's being very meager. Well, maybe that fellow doesn't have the means. Maybe he doesn't have the inclination. That's his cross to bear. No pun intended. But then we find within the greater organization this tremendous sense of giving, a willingness to proceed. yeah, we're a bit conservative about it. You know, I think we like things structured, and we like accountability. That's, you know, we don't want things just to be chaotic. We're not just handing out checks or take a roll of money and just hand it out at the on the curb. But we want to make sure that it's purposeful, that, you know, we are connecting with people that will make an opportunity. We want to create those opportunities. So I think this has a great deal of merit. There is a great deal of material here. In Masonic symbolism are implied references to a vast body of literature and philosophical doctrine, which is the core of Renaissance thought. Someone who really wants to understand the Masonic symbolism, and I think you and I could consider ourselves part of that, should read into and understand these those doctrines. It is from this perspective of Renaissance thought that we shall consider our symbolism, particularly in the context of the tracing boards and the experience of the degrees. Now, we can't move on with this without talking about metaphysics. That's a branch of philosophy that deals with God, with first principles, with the nature of being, and with the implications of those things which are, as the word implies, beyond physics. In some respects, it has become a dirty word. In the context of the positivism, which is fashionable today, to say something is metaphysical is to say that it is incapable of being proved. That, for many people who hold the contemporary point of view, is to say that it is meaningless. Until the beginning of 20th century, almost all philosophy in the West had a strong orientation toward the deity. And metaphysics was an important field. Metaphysics seeks to describe the structure of that part of the universe that is beyond the range of physical observation. It also deals with the matter in which the deity is understood to operate in the process of creating and maintaining the universe. There are many metaphysical systems in use throughout the world. For the last 2,000 years, those in the West have been dominated by the metaphysics based on some variant of Judeo-Christian monotheism. The Renaissance was similar, although it was also characterized by a revival of interest in the classical world, in particular the Greek and Roman civilizations and its thought. In recent years, there has been more positive orientation toward metaphysics. We have found that a significant portion of gentlemen aged 30 or under are often very interested. That got your attention, didn't it? This is a positive thing for Freemasonry. Ah, now we're unlocking some of the secrets. Head in sand over 30. I'm going to have a little talk with McNulty about that age. Pull head out of sand, take a look at what's going on with the younger fellows. Yeah, okay. Medieval scholars have been interested in classical philosophy from the point of view of reconciling it to Christian doctrine. Too bad. It's limited. I'm just saying. Renaissance thinkers are interested in classical philosophy for what it said about man himself. These Renaissance philosophers incorporated a good many Greek, particularly Neoplatonic, and Jewish mystical ideas into their Orthodox Christian thought. Probably, I wonder if he's going to get into the Kabbalism. You know, that very deep, very interesting. The first of these influences came principally from a body of writing called the Hermetica, which originated in Alexandria, Egypt, sometime shortly after the start of the Christian era. It seems to be a form of early Egyptian philosophy with a heavy overlay of Hellenized Judaism and Christian thought, and it has been shown to have had substantial influence on the formation of early Christian doctrines. The second of these influences came from Kabbalah, the mystical tradition of Judaism, which was dispersed throughout the Mediterranean basin by the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. Nice bunch. You have this faith, get out. Oh, glad it wasn't me, you know? That's what I'm saying. Glad somebody doesn't come along and say, Dale, you have these beliefs, you're a Freemason, you're out. You, your family, I'm glad, thank goodness. Francis Yates, a historian of thought at the Warburg Institute, University of London in the last century, has called this fusion of classical and Jewish philosophy the Hermetic Kabbalistic tradition. And after it had been interpreted in the context of Orthodox Christian doctrine. It was fundamental to the thought of the very early Renaissance. So you can get that here. I'm just going to give you a little. Go back and look. Francis A. Yates, The Occult Philosophy in the Elizabethan Age. Okay? That's the reference for that. Creators are separate from their creations, this says. Neoplatonism was also important in Renaissance thought. Very briefly, the idea of Neoplatonism is that God did not create the world. Creators are separate from their creations. And if God is separate from anything, God is limited, which is impossible. Rather, the Neoplatonist says God willed itself into existence as all that is. With all of this, I think the metaphysics of the Renaissance represents as close to a general statement of Western metaphysics as we are likely to find. Speculative Masonry dates from the end of the Renaissance to the middle to the late 17th century. And it seems to me that Masonic symbolism reflects this Renaissance tradition. Now remember, we have evidence that speculative Freemasonry was already underway. The Three Degrees were being practiced prior to the formation of the Grand Lodge, and certainly prior to the creation of the Constitution. True. Anyway, but not all of the influences. That's where I want to put my plug in for Jean Desolier. I digress nicely. Three fundamental ideas seem to characterize this philosophical view. You know, first, the deity was considered to be without limit. Neoplatonism. The deity was considered to be without limit. This resulted in a view of all existence as a single, tightly integrated unity centered on the deity. A particularly clear statement of this view comes from Hermetica. For God contains all things, and there is nothing that is not in God, and nothing which God is not. Nay, I would say rather, not that God contains all things, but that, to speak the full truth, God is all things. Second, earthly experiences were considered to reflect events in the heavenly realms. The succinct statement of this idea is, as above, so below. This epigram is a consequence of the integrative view of the world described above. In a universe regarded as a single, consistent, divine entity, there must be a correspondence between that which occurs in the higher, heavenly, casual levels and that which occurs in the lower, earthly ones. Third, knowledge of the higher or more subtle aspects of the universe was thought to be available only by experience. That is, by one's own revelation. Like, do you get it, to have that aha moment? Certainly not by logical argument, nor ultimately by faith in the authority of others' revelation. McNulty suggests that the Masonic symbolism, as represented on the tracing boards, reflects these principles which make up this worldview. The first degree tracing board, which looks at first glance like a collection of heterogeneous objects, is, I suggest, a representation of God, the universe and everything. It is also an image of a human being depicted in a landscape. Neither of these ideas is immediately obvious, but they are at least reasonable interpretations of the data. The central idea, which was fundamental to Renaissance thought, was the unity of the system and the consequent omnipresence of the universe. Consequent, this idea is represented on the first degree board by a group of three symbols which are called collectively the ornaments of the lodge. The fact that the Masons who formulated our symbolism gathered these three objects into a single group seems to require that we consider them together and in relation to each other. The ornaments of the lodge are the blazing star or glory, the checkered pavement, and the indented tessellated border. I suggest that they are all intended to refer to the deity. The blazing star shown in the heavens represents the deity as it is, in all its glory, as it projects itself into existence. The checkered pavement represents the deity as it is perceived to be in the opposite pole of consciousness, here on earth, in ordinary life. The light and dark squares represent paired opposites, a mixture of mercy and justice, reward and punishment, judgment and loving kindness. They represent the human experience of love, light and dark, good and evil, easy and difficult. But this is only how it is perceived. The squares are not the symbol. The pavement is the symbol. The light and dark squares fit together with exact nicety to form the pavement, a single thing, a unity. The whole is surrounded by the tessellated border which binds it into a single symbol. In its representation on the tracing board, the border binds not simply the squares, but the entire picture into a unity. The tassels can be thought of as representing divine agency which operates throughout the whole. Except in the case of the glory which stands alone, the idea of duality occurs throughout the board, from black and white squares at the bottom to the sun and the moon, an ancient symbol of the paired opposites of masculine and feminine at the top. In the central area of the board, duality is represented by two of the three columns. But here, above the fixity of the elemental existence of the physical world, the third column introduces a new idea. The striking thing about these columns is that each is of a different order of architecture. In Masonic symbolism, there is a characteristic associated with each order: wisdom with the Ionic column in the middle, strength with the Doric column on the left, and beauty with the Corinthian column on the right. What is the meaning of these columns and their names? As we have seen, one of the principal philosophical components of Renaissance thought was Kabbalah, or the Kabbalah, let me put it that way. That's how I say it. And in particular, it was the Sephardi Kabbalah, which spread throughout the Mediterranean era with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492. Several very significant books are written on the subject of the Kabbalah. The principal diagram which is used by Kabbalists to communicate their idea is the Tree of Life, which is shown in an adjacent figure here. I can't really show it, and I won't even begin to describe it. It's just too deep. You'll have to look at a graphic for yourself. There's the Tree of Life and the Tree of the Craft, even more esoteric and deeper. And then there's the frontispiece on Stephen Jones' book, The Masonic Miscellanies. And these are the things that are sitting here looking at me as context. We should notice here that the three columns, with those of mercy and severity held in balance by the column of consciousness. The three columns all terminate in divinity at the top of the central column. Consider again the columns on the tracing board. The Corinthian pillar of beauty is on the right. And in the classical world, the Corinthian order is thought to be suitable for buildings dedicated to vigorous, expansive activities. The Doric pillar of strength is on the left. And in the classical world, the Doric order was used for buildings where discipline, restraint, and stability were important. The Ionic pillar of wisdom is in the middle. The Ionic order is recognized as an intermediate between the other two and was used for temples to the rulers of the gods who coordinated the activities of the Pantheon. The three pillars, like the Tree of Life, speak of a universe in which expansive and constraining forces are held in balance by a coordinating agency. Masonic symbolism fits remarkably well on this diagram. And we will see that the Tree of Life illustrates the correlation with Freemasonry. It is explained in detail in an article that was written for Herodom. And you can get that. It's called McNulty, The Kabbalah and Freemasonry. And it's in Herodom number 7 from 1998. The officers of the lodge are on the column of consciousness with the Tyler at Malkut, the body, and the worshipful master at Beraya, the spirit. The uppermost triad is called the divine triad. The universe as it was perceived by the Renaissance philosophers consisted of four worlds. The Hermetica describes such a division, with each of the four worlds associated with one of the elements: fire, air, water, and earth. The Kabbalah has a similar division, as the tree above indicates. They are the elemental or physical world, body, and the celestial world of the psyche or soul, and the super-celestial world of spirit and the divine world. The divine world is open to indicate divinity is without limit. We can see that these same levels are represented on the board. The four levels are more obvious if one remembers that the general symbolical structure originates from a time when people believed in a geocentric universe with Earth at the center and heaven beyond the stars. The pavement represents the elemental physical world. The central part of the board, including the columns and most of the symbols, represents the celestial world of the psyche or the soul. The heavens represent the super-celestial world of the spirit, and the glory, as we have seen, represents the divinity. Thus far, we have considered how this picture conceives as a representation of the structure of the universe as was conceived by the intellectual community of the Renaissance. That is the landscape. And that leaves the question, where is the man? So, good enough? Right enough? Pleasant enough? Can we just leave it at that point? Let me just add here, what we'll do next week, we'll talk about, we're going to talk about where is man. We're going to talk about, we'll come back to this, and I'll add to, we want to finish up on the first tracing board and get into the second degree tracing board and begin to explain more of the symbolisms, Jacob's ladder and the point within a circle bounded with two parallel lines, those types of things. But and we're going to I'll talk to you a little bit about one of the notions of the travel, or the perhaps myths or bits of history about the traveling man. And one of the Masonic catechisms gives us little insight into this seldom used epithet. I'll just give you a little read. Here's just a little Q&A from a time gone past, okay? This is the first lecture. Question, did you ever travel? The answer you would give, my forefathers did. Question, where did they travel? The answer, due east and west. The question, what was the object of their travels? The answer, they traveled east in search of instruction and west to propagate the knowledge they had gained. That's from a time gone by. So we'll come back to that. I'd love to. And I look forward to doing that next week with you. So want to see, I need a segue here. And what better segue than Pythagoras? Little known. Often, you know, we parade around. It's like, you know, somebody walks around with a watch in their hand. I'm thinking, is it right? I stopped wearing a watch when I started asking this question. What in the world is time? Now I find I can't ask that. It's like, what is time-space? Yeah, I'm a bit foolish, perhaps. I still carry a pocket knife just in case. You don't use it every day. Here's some stuff about, you know, you always wonder, why Pythagoras? Why not Pliny or Epicurus? You know, there's so many brilliant, brilliant minds. Why Pythagoras? And, they tore down his temples, and there's very little known about the man to this day, the person. We know he existed. We know he had a school. Here's some quotes that I think will illustrate a little more about this fella. Friends are as companions on a journey who ought to aid each other to persevere in the road to a happier life. If he's saying that and he's believing that, sounds like the kind of fellow that I'd like to travel with. Above the cloud with its shadow is the star with its light. Above all things, reverence thyself. And this is a piece on music and geometry. There is geometry in the humming of the strings. There is music in the spacing of the spheres. Music in the spacing of the spheres. Do not say a little in many words, but a great deal in a few. Boy, Pythagoras, you sort of put me on the spot. I'm trying to wrap up a show here, buddy. All right, I'll try it. Good show. Love you. I get it. Do not say a little in many words. Think before you speak. Okay? No one is free who has not obtained the empire of himself. Again, there you go with that mirror. Take a look at it. There is nothing so easy, but that it becomes difficult when you do it reluctantly. Is he telling us to live with vigor when we approach something, to throw ourselves at it and do it in the best possible way? There is nothing so easy, but that it becomes difficult. So we find something that our own doing things reluctantly creates a difficulty, is what he's saying. You can see the precision here. This is like add this, add a task, and then add reluctance, and then what do we get? Difficulty. Begin thus from the first act and proceed, and in conclusion, at the ill which thou hast done, be troubled and rejoice for the good. Oh, and this I just love. Virtue is harmony. The harmonics between us, virtue. Live a virtuous life. Not an insufferable, pious, do it my way, I've got the world shining out my rear end type of existence. Yuck. Strength of mind rests in sobriety, but this keeps your reason unclouded by passion. For this keeps your reason unclouded by passion. It's really saying, if you have a drink, our passions cloud our reason. Yeah, I think I can live with that. As long as man continues to be the ruthless destroyer of lower living beings, he will never know health or peace. For as long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other. Choose rather to be strong of soul than strong of body. Over the past, this is something that I've realized over the past couple of weeks, months or so. I've been very short of breath, and it means that it's easier for me not to talk and lose my breath. You can tell I'm getting a little healthier because I can just begin to chatter away today. This just recently. Here he says, silence is better than unmeaning words. If you don't mean it, don't say it. Now that, I think, is something that Cyril, my grandfather, would say. Didn't call people liars, but he did call them a hypocrite. If you don't mean it, don't say it. If you're not as good as your word, you're useless. It is better whether to be silent or to say things of more value than silence. Sooner throw a pearl at hazard than an idle or useless word. And do not say a little in many words, but a great deal in a few. And he says, above all things, reverence yourself. The most momentous thing in human life is the art of winning the soul to good or evil. Rest satisfied with doing well and leave others to talk of you as they will. Do not talk a little on many subjects, but much on a few. I think I like that. As soon as laws are necessary for men, they are no longer fit for freedom. Does a good man really need all of these laws in order to help sort out how to live? To live in harmony, to live cooperatively, to get the fact that we are a great big community of people and it takes a great compromise in order to coordinate. And sometimes we do have to wait our turn. And that's all right, because that defines us. The oldest, shortest words, yes and no, are those which require the most thought. Concern should drive us into action and not into depression. No man is free who cannot control himself. I like that. Reason is immortal. All else is mortal. Now, here's one. I'll read this out. And I have great, you know, here's Pythagoras, you and I would have to have a drink, and I'm not going to agree with you on this one. There is a good principle which created order, light, and man, and an evil principle which created chaos, darkness, and women. Had problems with the girls, did you there, Pythagoras? Don't blame it on them, buddy. I'm just saying. Go take a look in the mirror. Enough of that. I'm going to want to make life easy. Are you feeling that spirit starting to come to the surface here? I hope so. I really do. Can you walk in that spirit? Too corny? Can you walk in that throughout the day? I hope you can. I'm just going to leave you with a little taste of living a good life. You know, how do you do it? Well, remember, this was topical material, and the fellows that were our ancient brethren would have read this. And, of course, this is from the life of Montaigne. How to live, of course. And he says, how to live, use little tricks. Little tricks in the art of living. About our academic philosophers, Montaigne was usually dismissive. He disliked their pedantries and abstractions, but he showed an endless fascination for another tradition in philosophy, that of the great pragmatic schools, which explored such questions as how to cope with a friend's death, how to work up courage, how to act well in morally difficult situations, and how to make the most of life. Man, I could use those lessons. These were the philosophies he turned to in times of grief and fear, as well as for guidance in dealing with every more minor everyday irritations. The three most famous such systems of thought were Stoicism, Epicureanism, and Skepticism. The philosophies collectively known as Hellenistic because they had their origins in the era when Greek thought and culture spread to Rome and other Mediterranean regions from the 3rd century BC onward. They differed in detail but were so close in the essentials as to be hard to distinguish much of the time. Like everyone else, Montaigne mixed and matched them according to his needs, and I expect the message here is for you and I to do the same. All the schools had the same aim, to achieve a way of living known in the original Greek as eudaimonia, often translated as happiness or joy. You know, so you think about this notion. If you have difficulty with the notion that the point of Freemasonry is happiness, it's not giggling, it's not walking around taking everything frivolously, but here I would suggest to you that this gives it a bit of gravity. That to achieve a way of living known as eudaimonia, which is translated into human flourishing. This meant living well in every sense, thriving, relishing life, and being a good person. They also agree with the best path to eudaimonia was ataraxia, which might be rendered as imperturbability or freedom from anxiety. Ataraxia means equilibrium, the art of maintaining an even keel, so that you neither exult when things go well nor plunge into despair when they go awry. To attain it is to have control over your emotions so that you are not battered and dragged about by them like a bone fought over by a pack of dogs. It was on the question of how to acquire such equanimity that the philosophers began to diverge. How do you do that? Each had a different idea, for example, of how far one should compromise with the real world. The original Epicurean community founded by Epicurus in the 4th century required followers to leave their families and live like cult members in a private garden. Skeptics preferred to remain amid the public hurly-burly like everyone else, but with a radically altered mental attitude. Stoics were somewhere in between. The best-known Stoic writers, Seneca and Epictetus, wrote for an elite Roman readership who were deeply involved in the affairs of the time and had no time for gardens, but who desired oases of tranquility and self-possession wherever they could find them. Stoics and Epicureans shared a great deal of their theory, too. They thought that the ability to enjoy life is thwarted by two big weaknesses: lack of control over emotions and a tendency to pay too little attention to the present. You know, why do I just feel like my old teacher grabbing me by the ear and saying, "Dale, pay attention"? I suppose she would have been vilified for doing it today, touching my ear, but thank you. If one could only get these two things right, controlling and paying attention, most other problems would take care of themselves. The catch is that both are almost impossible to do. So difficult are they that one cannot approach them head on. It is necessary to sidle in from lateral angles and trick oneself into achieving them. There. That's it. I'll leave you with a trick. That's all I can do today. Leave you with a trick. I think that's good. There's just so much. The influences, think about the influence. What influences your thinking, the kind of person you are? Well, of course, it's how you function day by day. That's remarkably important. Truly, it's remarkably important. And how you express, how you play out the person that you are is in the decisions. The way you portray yourself as a good person isn't just in your good mind. You're like, "I'm a total shit, I'm mean-spirited, and I'm a know-it-all, but essentially I know that I'm a good person underneath it all." Doesn't really matter to the rest of us, you know? Doesn't really matter. You have to demonstrate it. It's where we begin to listen to some of the works and the quotes of Pythagoras, you know? If you want any kind of influence, where does it start? Where does it end? Anyway, I don't mean to be preachy about it. We have enough things on our list to be preachy about, don't we? Enough people teaching us, telling us what to do. Constant. Anyway, thank you very much. I want to wrap up the show today. I hope it's been a bit useful. Talked about some things Masonic, and I hope that's been of some interest and elucidation. Did I talk about the Royal Society? Not really, did I? We ran out of time. What can I tell you? I hope that you found that the time that I invested was useful, bringing out some ideas that are helpful to you, and as you plod along, trying to understand what in the world is going on around us. In the meantime, I hope you put a smile on your face. I hope that smile influences the people around you, and I hope that it's sincere. If you're looking for a way to control your emotion, here's an interesting little physiological phenomena. If you smile, your mood will elevate. You can actually improve your mood by smiling. Try it. Oh, it's true. It's been proven over and over again. You have to be a real nut bar to be saying, "Oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be happy. I'm going to smile, but I'm not going to be happy." Really? You're a nutter if that's the way you're thinking. So go sit in the corner. Be grumpy by yourself. But if you're looking to put your best foot forward, and I think the listeners to Masonic Companion are of that group, try it. Put a smile on your face. The other day in the grocery store, I met a good friend, and what do you see? This just remarkable smile. It's like, you know, he makes you feel like he's so happy to see you. It's a wonderful experience. I want to thank him. We had to rush past each other, he on his way out, but just a wonderful experience. And every single time I see the fellow, it's the same. It's a tremendous experience. Anyway, I hope you will commit many acts of random Masonic kindness that you will be, and the best of them, the people will not ever be aware that it's a Mason behind it, and that the rest of the day you relax, you take everything that you do and throw yourself at it robustly. Don't be reluctant, because it creates the disappointment, doesn't it? It makes things difficult if we're reluctant. And are we going to follow the mathematician Pythagoras? We're going to have any influence? Well, nobody's really sat down and talked with me about the influence, even the quotes and the thinking of Pythagoras. Just, oh, there he is. You just throw him in the bag. And all I want to do is just introduce you. That's all I'm doing. Introduce you to some really wonderful ideas. But in the course of today's show, I began to think about the overlap, the connections. And I don't think so many connections are just random or coincidental. I think this is purposeful. And the people that pulled our ideas together and started to standardize it, I think that really needed to be done. Because, you know, you could easily get into some pretty silly types of practices. And what we were saying back in the early 18th century is saying, hey, this is serious. This is worth, we've got something here. We've got something good here. And it's worth preserving. And it's worth the risk of trying to standardize it. Yeah. And in fact, when you think about how it was standardized, it really doesn't create barriers. It's freeing. It's freeing within, and we are so fortunate that our ancient brethren created an atmosphere of such free intellectual discourse. And again, if you wander around the lodges of Ontario, you will find many examples, fine examples, where this, where people get it. Don't be trying to take a lodge that doesn't get it and make it conform. No. Gravitate to like-minded fellows, like-minded Masons. They're out there, wonderful, wonderful guys. And for all of the old guys, and I conclude myself into this, anybody older than me requires carbon testing, because, you know, anything that old we can't measure in years. I have to measure it in millennia. But the new fellows, the new boys, yeah, they are looking for metaphysics. We need to be able to have a sense of what it is and not just be blowing smoke. So you've heard a little bit today about what metaphysics is and the importance and how it functions and what it tells us. So when you're looking at it, think about things conceptually. These are concepts. And here, a little bit of a tuneful passage. Thank you very much for joining me. It's been wonderful having the company. And keep sending me your responses and letting me know. Is this on track? Obviously, you make more sense than I do. See ya. Oh, yeah. Christmas is coming.
How to buy online with debit. Movie tickets. Step one.
See you soon.